The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 1, continued.
Cassette 3, Side 2.
From Povenets, I reached the canal straight away and walked along it for a long stretch, keeping as close as possible to the locks so as to look them over. Forbidden zones, sleepy guards. But in some places things were clearly visible. The walls of the locks were just what they had been before, made from those very same rock-filled cribs. I could recognize them from their pictures. But Maslov's rhomboid gates had been replaced by metal gates and were no longer opened by hand. But why was everything so quiet? There were no people about. There was no traffic on the canal, nor in the locks. There was no hustle and bustle of service personnel. There were no steamer whistles. The lock gates stayed shut. It was a fine, serene June day, so why was it? And so it was that I passed five locks of the Povenets staircase, and after passing the fifth, I sat down on the bank. Portrayed on all our Bellamore cigarette packages, and so desperately needed by our country, "Why are you silent, Great Canal?" Someone in civilian clothing approached me with watchful eyes, so I played the simpleton. "Where could I get some fish?" "Yes, and how could I leave via the canal?" He turned out to be the chief of the locks guard. "Why," I asked him, "wasn't there any passenger traffic?" "Well," he acted astonished, "how could we? After all, the Americans would rush right over to see it. Until the war there had been passenger traffic, but not since the war." "Well, what if they did come and see it?" "Well, now, how could we let them see it?" "But why is no one traveling on it?" "They do, but not very many. You see, it is very shallow, 16 feet deep. They wanted to rebuild it, but in all probability they will build another next to it, one which will be all right from the beginning."
"You don't say, boss."
"We've long since known all about that. In 1934, no sooner had they finished passing out all the medals, than there was already a project for reconstructing it. And point number one was to deepen the canal. And the second was to build a deep water chain of locks for sea-going ships parallel to the existing locks. Haste makes waste. Because of that time limit imposed on its completion, because of those norms, they not only cheated on the depth, but reduced the tonnage capacity. There had to be some faked cubic feet in order to feed the sluggers. And very soon afterward they blamed this cheating on the engineers and gave them new tenors. And 50 miles of the Murmansk Railroad had had to be removed to make room for the canal route. It was at least a good thing that they hadn't wasted any wheelbarrow wheels on the project. And what were they to haul on it anyway? And where? They had cut down all the nearby timber, so where was it to be hauled from? Was Archangel timber to be hauled to Leningrad? But it was sold right in Archangel. Foreigners had been buying it there since long ago. Yes, for half the year the canal is frozen anyhow, maybe more. So what was it needed for, anyway? Oh, yes, there was a military necessity in order to be able to ship the fleet.
"It's so shallow," complained the chief of the guard, "that not even submarines can pass through it under their own power. They have to be loaded on barges, and only then can they be hauled through."
"And what about the cruisers?"
"Oh, you hermit tyrant, you nighttime lunatic. In what nightmare did you dream up all this? And where, cursed one, were you hurrying to? What was it that burned and pricked you to set a deadline of 20 months? For those 250,000 men could have remained alive. Well, so the Esperantists stuck in your throat, but think how much work those peasant lads could have done for you. How many times you could have roused them to attack for the motherland, for Stalin.
It was very costly, I said to the guard. But it was built very quickly, he answered me with self-assurance. Your bones should be in it. That day I spent 8 hours by the canal. During this time there was one self-propelled barge which passed from Povenets to Soroka, and one identical in type which passed from Soroka to Povenets. Their numbers were different, and it was only by their numbers that I could tell them apart, and be sure that it was not the same one as before on its way back. Because they were loaded altogether identically, with the very same pine logs which had been lying exposed for a long time,
and were useless for anything except firewood. And cancelling the one load against the other, we get zero. And a quarter of a million to be remembered. And after the White Sea Baltic Canal came the Moscow-Volga Canal. The sloggers all moved over to it immediately, as well as Chief of Camp Firin and Chief of Construction Kogan. Their orders of Lenin for Belomor reached both of them there. But this canal was at least needed, and it gloriously continued and developed all the traditions of Belomor, and we can understand even better here how the archipelago in the period of rapid metastasis differed from stagnant Solovki. Now was the time to remember and regret the silent cruelties of Solovki, for now they not only demanded work of the prisoners, they not only demanded that the prisoners break up the unyielding rocks with their failing picks. No, while taking away life, they even earlier crawled into the breast and searched the soul. And this was the most difficult thing to bear on the canals. They demanded that in addition to everything else, you chirp. You might be on your last legs, but you had to make a pretense of participation in public affairs. With a tongue growing numb from hunger, you had to deliver speeches demanding over-fulfillment of plan and exposure of wreckers and punishment for hostile propaganda, for kulak rumors, and all camp rumors were kulak rumors, and to be on the lookout to make sure that the snakes of mistrust did not entwine a new prison term about you. Picking up these shameless books where the life of the doomed is portrayed so glossily and with such admiration, it is almost impossible to believe that they were written in all seriousness and also read in all seriousness. Yes, and circumspect Glavlit destroyed the printings, so that in this case, too, we got one of the last existing copies. And now our Virgil will be the assiduous pupil of Vyshinsky, I. L. Averbach. Even driving in a single screw takes at first some special effort. The axis must be kept straight, and the screw has to be kept from leaning to one side. But when it has already begun to take hold, one can then free one hand and just keep screwing it in, whistling. We read Vyshinsky. Thanks in particular to its educational task, our corrective labor camp, ITL, is fundamentally counterposed to the bourgeois prison where raw violence reigns. In contrast to bourgeois states, the use of violence in the struggle against crime plays a role of secondary importance, and the center of gravity has passed over to organizational, material, cultural, educational, and political indoctrinational measures. You really have to furrow your brains not to burst out. Instead of the club, the ration scale, plus propaganda. And here is some more. The success of socialism also exercised their magical, that's what's sculpted there, magical, influence on the struggle against crime. Following in his teacher's footsteps, Averbach similarly elaborates, the task of Soviet corrective labor policy is the transformation of the nastiest human material. Do you remember raw material? Do you remember insects? A.S. into worthwhile, fully useful, active, and conscientious builders of socialism. There is just the question of that little coefficient. A quarter million of nasty material lay down and died, and 12,500 of the active and conscientious were liberated ahead of time. Belomor. Yes, and wasn't it back at the Eighth Party Congress in 1919, when the Civil War was still blazing, when they were still waiting for Denikin near Orel, when Kronstadt and the Tambov Revolt were still in the future, that the Congress declared and determined to replace the system of punishments, in other words, in general, not to punish anyone at all, with a system of education? Compulsory, Averbach now adds. And rhetorically, already saving up for us the annihilating reply, he asks, but how else? How can one remake consciousness for the benefit of socialism if in freedom it has already become hostile to it, and camp compulsion is perceived as violence and can only intensify the hostility? So we and the reader are caught in a blind alley. Is it not true? But that's not the end of it. And now he is going to dazzle us blind. Productive, meaningful labor with a high purpose. That's the means by which all hostile or unreliable consciousness will be remade. And for that, it seems, we need to concentrate our work on gigantic projects which astound the imagination with their grandeur. Ah, so that's it. That's why we need Bellomore. And we dunderheads didn't understand a thing. By this means are attained immediacy, effectiveness, and the pathos of construction. And at the same time, work from zero to completion is obligatory. And every camp inmate, who is not yet dead as of today, feels the political resonance of his personal labor, the interest of the entire country in his work. Please notice how smoothly the screw is now going in.
Perhaps it is a bit crooked, but are we not losing the capacity to resist it?
The father marked a line on the map with his pipe, and is there some anxiety about justifying him? An Averbach always turns up. Andrei Yanuarievich, here is an idea I've had. What do you think about it? Should I develop it in a book? But those are only frills. What was required was that the prisoner, while still confined in camp, be indoctrinated in the highest socialist forms of labor. And what was required for that? The screw had gotten stuck. What muddle-headedness. Of course, socialist competition and the shock worker movement. What millennium is it, darlings, out of doors? Not just work, but heroic work. Ogpu Order Number 190. Competition for temporary possession of the red banner of the central staff, of the district staff, of the division staff. Competition between camps, construction sites, brigades. Along with the transferable red banner, a brass band was also awarded. For whole days at a time, it played for the winners during work periods and during periods of tasty food. There is no tasty food to be seen in the photograph, but you can see the searchlight. That was for night work. The Moscow-Volga Canal was constructed around the clock. A band was used in other camps as well. They put it on the shore, and it played for several days in a row until prisoners working without relief or rest periods had unloaded timber from a barge. IDT was in a band at Bellomore, and he recalls, "The band aroused anger among those working. After all, the musicians were released from general work, had their own individual cots and their own military uniforms. They used to shout at us, 'Parasites, drones, come here and get to work.' In the photograph, neither this nor anything like it is shown." In every brigade of prisoners, there was a troika concerned with competition, audit and resolutions, resolutions and audit. The results of the storm assault on the watershed for the first five-day period, for the second. The intercamp newspaper was called Perekovka, Reforging. Its slogan was, "Let us drown our past on the bottom of the canal." Its appeal, "Work without days off." Universal enthusiasm, universal agreement. The leading shock worker said, "Of course, how can there be days off? The Volga doesn't have days off, and it's just about to overflow its banks." "And what about days off on the Mississippi?" "Grab him, he's a kulak agent." A point in the obligations undertaken. Preservation of health by every member of the collective. Oh, what humanitarianism. No, here's what it was for. To reduce the amount of absenteeism. Do not be ill and do not take time off. Red bulletin boards. Black bulletin boards. Bulletin boards of charts. Days remaining until completion. Work done yesterday, work done today. The honor roll. In every barracks, honor certificates. A bulletin board of reforging, graphs, diagrams. And how many loafers were scurrying about and writing all this stuff? Every prisoner had to be informed about the production plans. And every prisoner had to be informed about the entire political life of the country. Therefore, at morning line-up, taken out of morning free time, of course, there was a five-minute production session. And after returning to camp, when one's legs could hardly keep one upright, there was a five-minute political session. During lunch hours, prisoners were not to be allowed to crawl into nooks and crannies or to sleep. There were political readings. If, out in freedom, the six conditions of Comrade Stalin were proclaimed, then every camp inmate had to learn them by heart.
It is worth noting that intellectuals who had managed to make their way up to positions in management took advantage of these six conditions very adroitly. To make use of specialists by every possible means meant to yank engineers off general work. Not to permit turnover in the workforce meant to prohibit prisoner transports. If in freedom there was a decree of the Council of People's Commissars on dismissing workers for absenteeism, then here explanatory work had to be undertaken. Every person who today refuses to work or who simulates illness must, after his liberation, be branded with the contempt of the masses of the Soviet Union. The system here was this. In order to get the title of shock worker, it was not enough merely to have production successes. It was necessary, in addition, A, to read the newspapers, B, to love your canal, C, to be able to talk about its significance. And miracle, O transfiguration and ascension, the shock worker ceases to feel discipline and labor as something which has been forced on him from outside. Even horses understand this. It becomes an inner necessity. Well, truly, of course, freedom, after all, is not freedom, but accepted bars. New socialist forms of reward. The issuing of shock workers' buttons. And what would you have thought? What would you have thought? The shock workers' button is valued by the sloggers more highly than rations. Yes, more highly than rations. And whole brigades voluntarily go out to work 2 hours before line-up. What presumption! But what was the convoy to do? And they also stayed behind to work after the end of the workday. O flame, O matches, they thought you would burn for decades. Here it is, shock work. A thunderstorm breaks, but we are going to work anyway. We are going to overfulfill the day's plan. Remark the technology. We spoke of it at the Bellamore, too. On the slopes, a hookman hauls the wheelbarrow from the front. Indeed, how else could it be made to roll upward? Ivan Nemtsev suddenly decided to do the work of 5 men. No sooner said than done. He moved 72 cubic yards of earth in 1 shift. Let us calculate. That is 6.5 cubic yards per hour. 1 cubic yard every 9 minutes. Just try it, even with the lightest type of soil. This was the situation. There were no pumps. No wells had been readied, and water had to be fought off with one's hands. And what about the women? They used to lift, unaided, stones of up to 150 pounds. Wheelbarrows overturned and stones struck head and feet. That's all right. We'll manage. Sometimes up to their waists in water. Sometimes 62 hours of unbroken work. Sometimes for 3 days 500 persons hacked at the frozen earth. And it turned out to be to no avail. That's all right. We'll manage. With our battle spades, we dug our happiness near Moscow. This was that same special gay tension they had brought with them from Bellamore. They went on the attack with boisterous gay songs. In any weather, march out to line up. And here are the shock workers themselves. They have come to the rally. On one side, by the train, is the chief of convoy, and on the left there is one more convoy guard. Look at their inspired and happy faces. These women do not think about children nor about home, but only about the canal which they have come to love so. It is quite cold, and some are in felt boots, some are in ordinary boots, homemade, of course. And the second from the left in the first row is a woman thief in stolen shoes, and where better to go swaggering about in them than at the rally? And here is another rally. It says on the poster, "We will build it ahead of time, cheaply and strong." And how do we reconcile all that? Well, let the engineers break their heads over it. It is easy to see in the photograph that there are shadows of smiles for the camera, but in general these women are terribly fatigued. They are not going to make speeches, and all they expect from the rally is a nourishing meal for once. All of them have simple, peasant-like faces. All the photographs are from Averbach's book. He warned that there were no photographs of kulaks and wreckers in it, in other words, of the finest peasants and intellectuals. Evidently, so to speak, their time has not yet come. Alas, it never will. You can't bring back the dead. And the trusty guard got stuck in the aisle, the Judas he so much wanted to get into that photograph. And here is a shock brigade provided with the last word in equipment. It is not true that we haul everything under our own steam. If we are to believe the camp artists whose works were exhibited in the KVCH, the cultural and educational section, then this is the equipment already in use at the canal. One excavator, one crane, and one tractor. Are they in working order? Perhaps they're broken down. Isn't that more likely? Well, generally speaking, in winter it isn't very cozy out on the construction site, right? There was one small additional problem. At the time Bellomore was completed, too many triumphant articles appeared in various newspapers, and they nullified the terrorizing effects of the camps. In the description of Bellomore, they overdid it to such a degree that those who arrived at the Moscow-Volga Canal expected rivers of milk and honey and presented unheard-of demands to the administration. Presumably they asked for clean linen? So that was it. Go ahead and lie as much as you please, but don't get entangled in your lying. Today, too, the banner of Bellomore waves over us, writes the newspaper, reforging. That's a moderate statement, and it is quite enough. In any event, both at Bellomore and at the Moscow-Volga Canal, they understood that camp competition and the shock worker movement must be tied in with the entire system of rewards, so that the special rewards would stimulate the shock worker movement. The principal basis of competition is material incentive. It would seem we've been thrown about face. We have turned from east to west, 180 degrees. Is this a provocation? Hold tight to the handrails. The car is going through. And things worked out like this. On production indices depended nutrition and housing and clothing and linen and the frequency of baths. Yes, yes, whoever works badly can go about in tatters and lice. And liberation ahead of time, and rest days, and visits. For example, issuing a shock worker's lapel button is purely a socialist form of encouragement. But let that button confer the right to a long visit out of turn. And by this means it becomes more precious than bread rations. If in freedom, in accordance with the Soviet Constitution, we apply the principle of whoever does not work does not eat, then why should we put the camp inmates in a privileged position? The most difficult thing in organizing a camp, they must not become privileged places. The ration scale at Dmitlag was this. The penalty ration consisted of muddy water and 10.5 ounces of bread. 100% fulfillment of norm earned the right to 28 ounces of bread, and the right to buy, in addition, 3.5 ounces in the camp commissary. And then, submission to discipline begins out of egotistical motives, self-interest in getting a better bread ration, and rises to the second step of socialist self-interest in the red banner. In his private life, Averbuch probably began immediately with the second step. But the main thing was time off sentence. Time off sentence. The Socialist Competition Headquarters compiled a report on the prisoner. For time off sentence, not only over-fulfillment of plan is required, but also social work. And anyone who in the past has been a non-working element gets reduced time off sentence, miserly small. Such a person can only pretend, not reform. He must be kept in camp longer, so as to be verified. For example, he pushes a wheelbarrow uphill, and maybe he isn't working but just pretending. And what do those who are freed ahead of time do? What do you mean, what? They stay with the project. They have come to love the canal too much to leave it. They are so absorbed in it that when they are liberated, they voluntarily stay at the canal, engaging in earth-moving operations right to the end of the project. They voluntarily remain at work like that. Can one believe the author? Of course. After all, they all have a stamp in their passport. Was in Ogfu camps. You aren't going to find work anywhere else. But what is this? The machinery for producing nightingale trills has suddenly broken down, and in the intermission we hear the weary breath of truth. Even the thieves were only 60% involved in competition. It is pretty bad if even the thieves don't compete. The camp inmates often interpret the special benefits and rewards as incorrectly applied. Recommendations of prisoners are often composed tritely. Very often, trustees pass themselves off on recommendations as shock worker excavators and receive a shock worker's time-off sentence, while the real shock worker often gets none. In our country, everything is topsy-turvy, and even rewards sometimes turn out to be a misfortune. The blacksmith Paramonov received 2 years off his 10-year sentence in one of the Archangel camps for the excellence of his work. But because of this 2-year reduction, he completed his term during wartime, and as a result, being a 58, he was not released, but was kept there under special decree. Special, once again. Just as soon as the war was over, Paramonov's co-defendants, convicted with him in the same case, completed their 10-year sentences and were released. And he dragged out another whole year. The prosecutor studied his case and couldn't do a thing. The special decree remained in force throughout the entire archipelago. And so it would seem, gentlemen instructors, that it was you who had not managed to rise to the second step. And there were many who clung to feelings of hopelessness and injustice.
Well, and in 1931, the Fifth Conference of Justice Officials condemned this whole snake pit. The widespread and totally unjustified application of parole and time-off sentence for workdays leads to diminution of the impact of sentences, to the undermining of the repression of crime, and to distortions in the class line.
But the trills have begun again with a metallic ring. The main incentive had evidently been forgotten. Cruel and merciless application of disciplinary penalties. Ogpu Order of November 28, 1933. This was at the beginning of winter, so they would stand still without rocking back and forth. All incorrigible loafers and malingerers are to be sent to distant northern camps with total deprivation of rights to any privileges. Malicious strikers and troublemakers are to be turned over to trial by camp collegia. For the slightest attempt to violate iron discipline, prisoners are to be deprived of all special privileges and advantages already received. For example, for attempting to get warm beside the fire. And nonetheless, we have again omitted the main link, total confusion. We have said everything, but we didn't say the main thing. Listen. Listen. Collectivity is both the principle and the method of Soviet corrective labor policy. After all, there have to be driving belts from the administration to the masses. Only by basing itself on collectives can the multitudinous camp administration rework the consciousness of the prisoners. From the lowest forms of collective responsibility to the highest forms is a matter of honor, a matter of glory, a matter of valor and heroism. We often abuse our language, claiming that with the passage of the ages it has grown pale. But if one really thinks about this, it is not true. It becomes more noble. Earlier, in the manner of cabmen, we said reins, and now driving belts. It used to be called mutual back-scratching. You help me out of the ditch, and I'll help you out of the swamp. But that smells of the stable, too. And now it's collective responsibility. The brigade is the basic form of re-education. Admitlag Order, 1933. This means trust in the collective, which is impossible under capitalism, but which is quite possible under feudalism. One man in the village is at fault, strip them all and whip them. Nonetheless, it sounds noble. Trust in the collective. That means the spontaneous initiative of the camp inmates in the cause of re-education. This is psychological enrichment of the personality by the collective. No, what words, what words. After all, he's knocked us right down with this psychological enrichment. Now there's a real scholar for you. The collective heightens the feeling of human dignity, yes, yes, of every prisoner, and by this means hinders the introduction of a system of moral repression. And indeed, please tell me, 30 years after Averbach, it was my fate to say a word or so about the brigade. All I did was describe how things worked there, but people managed to understand me in quite the opposite sense, in a distorted way.
The brigade is the basic contribution of communism to the science of punishment. And that is quite right. That is precisely what Averbach is saying. It is a collective organism living, working, eating, sleeping, and suffering together in pitiless and forced symbiosis. Ernst Powell, The Triumph of Survival, The Nation, February 2, 1963. Oh, without the brigade, one could still somehow manage to survive the camp. Without the brigade, you are an individual. You yourself choose your own line of conduct. Without the brigade, you can at least die proudly. But in the brigade, the only way they allow you even to die is in humiliation on your belly. From the chief, from the camp foreman, from the jailer, from the convoy guard, from all of them you can hide and catch a moment of rest. You can ease up a bit here on hauling, shirk a bit there on lifting. But from the driving belts, from your comrades in the brigade, there is neither a hiding place nor salvation nor mercy. You cannot not want to work. You cannot, conscious of being a political, prefer death from hunger to work. No, once you have been marched outside the compound, once you have been registered as going out to work, everything the brigade does today will be divided not by 25, but by 26. And because of you, the entire brigade's percentage of norm will fall from 123 to 119, which makes the difference between the ration allotted record breakers and ordinary rations. And everyone will lose a millet cake and 3.5 ounces of bread. And that is why your comrades keep watch on you better than any jailers. And the brigade leader's fist will punish you far more effectively than the whole People's Commissariat of Internal Affairs. Now that is what spontaneous initiative in re-education means. That is psychological enrichment of the personality by the collective. So now, it is all as transparent as a window pane. Yet on the Moscow-Volga Canal, even the organizers themselves still did not dare believe what a strong dog collar they had found. And there the brigade was kept in the background, and the labor collective was elevated to the position of highest honor and incentive. Even in May 1934, half the Zeks in Dmitlag were still unorganized. They were not accepted in the labor collectives. They did take them into labor cooperatives, but not all of them. They did not take in priests, sectarians, or other religious believers. Unless they renounced their religion, the game was worth the candle, in which case they were accepted with 1 month's probation. They began to take 58s into the labor collectives unwillingly, but only those whose terms were less than 5 years. The collective had a chairman, a council, and the democracy there was quite unbridled. The meetings of the collective took place only with the permission of the KVCH, the Cultural and Educational Section, and only in the presence of the company, yes, indeed, they had companies too, instructor. It goes without saying that the collectives were given higher rations than the mob. The best collectives had vegetable gardens allotted to them in the compound, not to individual people, but, as on a collective farm, to supplement the common pot. The collectives split into sections, and every free hour was filled with either checking the daily living routine or inquests into thefts and the squandering of government property, of publication of a wall newspaper, or delving into disciplinary violations. At the meetings of the collectives, they spent hours in pretentious discussion of such questions as how to reforge Lazy Bones Vovka, or Grishka, the malingerer. The collective itself had the right to expel its own members and ask that they be deprived of time off sentence. But, as a more drastic measure, the administration could dissolve entire collectives which were continuing criminal traditions, which were not, in other words, immersed in collective life. However, the most entertaining were the periodic purges of the collectives, of loafers, of the unworthy, of whisperers, who depicted the labor collectives as organizations for spying on one another, and of agents of the class enemy who had crept into their midst. For example, it was discovered that someone, already in camp, was concealing his kulak descent, for which he had, in fact, been sent to camp in the first place. And so now he was branded and purged, not from the camp, but from the labor collective. realist artists, please paint that picture. The purge in the labor collective. Those shaven heads, those watchful expressions, those fatigued faces, those rags on the body, and those enraged orators. Right here is a prototype. And for those who find it hard to imagine, well, this sort of thing took place in freedom too, and in China. And listen to this. As a preliminary, the task and the purposes of the purge were communicated to every camp inmate, and at that point every member of the collective gave public accounting. All the citations not otherwise credited are from Averbach's book, but sometimes I have combined phrases from different places, sometimes passed over his intolerable prolixity. After all, he had to stretch it out into a dissertation, but we don't have the space. However, I have nowhere distorted the meaning. And then, too, there was exposure of fake shock workers and elections of the Cultural Council and official rebukes to those who had done poorly at liquidating their illiteracy. And there were the classes in liquidation of illiteracy, too. We are not slaves, slaves we are not. And the songs, too. This kingdom of swamps and lowlands will become our happy native land. Or, in the masterful words of Nikolai Asayev, the poet himself, we canal army men are a tough people, but not in that lies our chief trait. We were caught up by a great epoch, to be put on the path that leads straight. Or, at the amateur theatricals, bursting from the breast, and even the most beautiful song cannot tell, no, cannot do justice to this country than which there is nothing more wondrous, the country in which you and I live. Songbooks of Dmitlag, 1935, and the music was called Canal Army Music, and there were free composers on the competition committee, Shostakovich, Kabalevsky, Schechter. Now that is what to chirp means in camp slang. Oh, they will drive you to the point where you will weep just to be back with company commander Kurilko, walking along the short and simple execution road through open and above-board Solovki slavery. My lord, what canal is there deep enough for us to drown that past in? Chapter 4. The archipelago hardens. And the clock of history was striking. In 1934, at the January plenum of the Central Committee and Central Control Commission of the Soviet Communist Party, the great leader, having already in mind, no doubt, how many he would soon have to do away with, declared that the withering away of the state, which had been awaited virtually from 1920 on, would arrive via, believe it or not, the maximum intensification of state power. This was so unexpectedly brilliant that it was not given to every little mind to grasp it, but Vyshinsky, ever the loyal apprentice, immediately picked it up. And this means the maximum strengthening of corrective labor institutions. Entry into socialism via the maximum strengthening of prison. And this was not some satirical magazine cracking a joke either, but was said by the Prosecutor General of the Soviet Union. And thus it was that the iron grip of the Yezhov terror was prepared even without Yezhov. After all, the second five-year plan, and who remembers this? For no one in our country ever remembers anything, for memory is the Russians' weak spot, especially memory of the bad. The second five-year plan included among its glistening, and to this very day unfulfilled, goals the following. The uprooting of the vestiges of capitalism from people's consciousness. This meant that this process of uprooting had to be finished by 1938. Judge for yourself, by what means were these vestiges to be so swiftly uprooted? Soviet places of confinement on the threshold of the second five-year plan not only are not losing, but are even gaining in significance. Not 1 year had passed since Kogan's predictions that camps would soon cease to exist at all, but Kogan did not know about the January plenum. In the epoch of entrance into socialism, the role of corrective labor institutions as weapons of the dictatorship of the proletariat, as organs of repression, as means of compulsion of education, compulsion is already in the first place, must grow still further and be strengthened. For otherwise, what was to happen to the command corps of the NKVD? Was it just supposed to disappear? So who is going to reproach our progressive doctrine with having fallen behind practice? All this was printed in black on white, but we still didn't know how to read. The year 1937 was publicly predicted and provided with a foundation. And the hairy hand tossed out all the frills and gewgaws, too. Labour collectives? Prohibited. What nonsense was that? Self-government in camp. You couldn't think up anything better than the brigade, anyway. What's all this about political indoctrination periods? Forget it. The prisoners are sent there to work, and they don't have to understand anything. At Uxtar, they had proclaimed the liquidation of the last multiple bunk. This was a political mistake. Were the prisoners to be put to bed on cots with springs? Cram them on the bunks twice as thickly. Time off sentences. Abolish that before anything. What do you want? That the court's work should go for nothing? And what about those who already have credits toward time off sentences? Consider them cancelled. 1937. They are still permitting visits in some camps? Forbid them everywhere. Some prisoner or other permitted a priest's body to be turned over for burial outside prison? You must be insane. You are providing an opportunity for anti-Soviet demonstrations. There must be an exemplary punishment for this. Now make it clear the corpses of deceased prisoners belong to Gulag, and the location of graves is top secret. Professional and technical courses for prisoners? Dissolve them. They should have done their studying in freedom. And what about VTSIK? What VTSIK anyway? Over Kalinin's signature? And we don't have a GPU, we have an NKVD. When they return to freedom, let them study on their own. Graphs, diagrams, tear them off the wall and whitewash the walls. And you don't even have to whitewash them. And what kind of payroll is this? Wages for prisoners? A Gumzak circular dated November the 25th, 1926. 25% of the wages of a worker of equivalent skill in state industry. Shut up and tear it up. We are robbing ourselves of wages. A prisoner should be paid. Let him say thank you. He wasn't shot. The Corrective Labour Code of 1933? Forget it once and for all. Take it out of all camp safes. Every violation of nationwide codes on labour, only on the basis of agreement with the Central Council of Trade Unions, the VTS-SPS... Do you really think we are going to go to the VTS-SPS? What's the VTS-SPS anyway? All we have to do is spit on it, and it will blow away. Article 75. The rations are to be increased for heavier labour? About face. Rations are to be reduced for easier work. Just like that, and the food allotment is intact. The Corrective Labour Code, with its hundreds of articles, was swallowed up as if by a shark. And not only was it true that for 25 years afterward no one caught a glimpse of it, but even its name was unsuspected. They shook up the archipelago, and they became convinced that beginning back there with Solovki, and even more so during the period of the canals, the entire camp machinery had become intolerably loose. And now they got rid of all that weakness. In the very first place, the whole guard system was no good. These weren't real camps at all. They had guards posted on the watchtowers only at night, and at the gatehouse there was just one unarmed guard who could even be persuaded to let one out for a bit.
This book is continued on Cassette 4, Side 1.